Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We welcome this morning Waupun High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. The students are here with a program called Court with Class. This is a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. And if they accept, they've been given the briefs in the case you're about to hear and may engage in other activities relating to this case. They come, listen to oral argument, and then meet with a justice of this court after the second case, which is about noon. And at that noon session, a discussion is had about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the cases that we are hearing. Everyone is invited to join the justice at that noon session. It's not limited to the students. Does anyone need a summary of the case we are about to hear so that you may better understand the case? If you raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Well, hearing none, let me introduce the court to you. On my far left is Lewis Butler, Justice Butler. And seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you're going to meet at noon. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Robinsack. With these preliminaries completed, I'm going to call the first case for today, 2005-AP-302-CR, State of Wisconsin versus Jenkins. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Maura J. F.J. Whalen, Assistant Attorney General. Ms. Whalen.
The court, I'm Maura Whalen, representing the state in this case. I reserve 5 minutes at the end of argument for rebuttal.
You got it.
Thank you. This case involves a pre-sentence plea withdrawal motion and the respective roles properly played by the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals in evaluating that motion. The fair and just reason identified by the defendant for the withdrawal of his plea was his genuine misunderstanding of the possibility of cooperating with law enforcement authorities and the possible impact that cooperation would have on his sentence. The Circuit Court, relying on Jenkins' plea colloquy and his denial of the existence of any promises in exchange for his plea, concluded that his asserted misunderstanding was not credible. The Court of Appeals, ignoring both the plea colloquy and the Circuit Court's credibility determination, concluded instead that the asserted, quote, misunderstanding was corroborated with undisputed substantial evidence in the record, close quote, citing a letter from defense counsel to Jenkins and defense counsel's statements at Jenkins' sentencing hearing. In ruling as it did, the Court of Appeals erred because it failed to defer to the Circuit Court's credibility finding, reweighed the facts to make its own independent factual determination, but in so doing failed to acknowledge or analyze the facts of record that supported the trial court's conclusion. The State believes that the record clearly supports the Circuit Court's decision. The State relies on two portions of the record, both of which consist of in-court statements by the defendant to the court. First, the plea colloquy. The court asked Jenkins if, other than what the State has agreed to recommend, has anybody promised you anything to get you to plead guilty here today? Jenkins answered, no, they haven't. The Circuit Court found the plea colloquy credible. Jenkins has never explained why he told the court he received no promises if, in fact, he genuinely understood that he had received promises. He has never claimed that he was instructed by defense counsel or the state to answer falsely in this regard. He has never claimed that he didn't understand this question. Neither the Court of Appeals nor Jenkins in his post-conviction motion and briefs on appeal has ever attempted to explain how this statement fits into Jenkins' claim of misunderstanding.
Counsel, how much you think weight we should put, or obviously the Court of Appeals put, on the on Jenkins' understanding of this letter? Normally, there aren't letters back and forth as far as cooperating with the police. And here it was, this was a heroin buy. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that the circuit court, that this is raised by opposing counsel, focused more on what the attorney's understanding rather than Jenkins. In other words, Jenkins thought that he, as he explained it, that he had a deal and he was going to do some work for the undercover people, and that would make a difference in this sentence. Why isn't that reasonable?
Okay. I really see two questions there. The first question goes back to what the Court of Appeals said, that the circuit court was focusing on what the attorneys thought was going on rather than what Jenkins thought was going on. However, I do not believe that the record really supports that dichotomy. I think that it actually supports the opposite dichotomy, which is the two pieces of evidence that I see supporting the state's view, if you will, are statements by Jenkins personally in court. One is the plea colloquy answer that we just reviewed, and the second is the statement he made to the court when the court said, well, what was your understanding here? And Mr. Jenkins made a long statement about how he wanted an opportunity to help Milwaukee and closed by saying it's not too much about the time.
Now, just so I'm not mistaken, did the court really talk about his innocence? Did they really talk about that he felt he was innocent? I know what the transcript, he used the word totally, and that when it came to was he guilty. But there seemed to be a lack of, many of the cases talk about, well, that's a necessary component, an assertion of innocence. That doesn't exist here, but it kind of was passed over in the night, wasn't it, as far as what the courts felt about the assertion of innocence? They talked about other things.
If I understand, you're noting that both courts ignored
right.
the assertion
both courts,
of innocence.
Right.
Yes, and the circuit court did not address the assertion of innocence issue. That is correct. The Court of Appeals, rather than simply not addressing the assertion of innocence factor, went so far as to say that it could be totally ignored, which I think is troubling and inconsistent with the precedents in both Dewdry and Kennedy.
Ms. Whalen, wasn't there an assertion of innocence by the defendant as far as his request for withdrawal? Didn't he claim that there was misidentification? Isn't that his assertion of innocence here?
Well, he does raise that in his post-conviction motion, and he also says, I am innocent, someone named Kay did it. The problem with, and as far as the misidentification, that's not necessarily an assertion of innocence. That's more saying, I actually had a good basis for challenging the evidence.
Well, he brought a motion to suppress the identification, didn't he?
Yes, he did, and that motion was withdrawn.
And then later on, as part of this process, he claimed misidentification again.
Yes, he did. He did reiterate that. The problem, I think, from Mr. Jenkins' viewpoint of his assertion of innocence is that it is not credible. I have 2 points for saying that. One, I think, more persuasive than the other. First of all, when asked if he was pleading guilty, because he was guilty, instead of just saying yes, he responded with a very robust totally. But more persuasive, I think, is the fact that when asked if the criminal complaint provided a factual basis for his guilty plea, instead of just answering yes, which we frequently see, he said, well, yeah, except it wasn't really accurate because they said we talked about the buy and that's not what happened because it doesn't happen because you know what's going on. So, and I think the court said, well, then how did you know either how much to give them or how much to be paying? He said, well, you just know. You know, I gave them this amount and so obviously they were going to give this amount.
But how important is the assertion of innocence being credible? In looking at the overall requirement of a fair and just reason to withdraw the plea? How does it relate?
Well, that's really 2 questions. First, of how important the assertion of innocence is and how,
right,
and must it be credible? It's hard for me to understand how. Let's just first assume that the assertion of innocence must be made. If it is an important factor, it seems that it has to be credible. We don't have any explicit statement from the Wisconsin courts saying that, but it just doesn't make any sense that you can just say, oh, and by the way, I'm innocent, despite anything I might have said at the plea hearing. I think if we look at the more general statement made in Kivioha, that a defendant must bring forward evidence that the circuit court finds believable in order to support his motion for plea withdrawal can be applied to the specific question about the assertion of innocence. I also did find cases from other jurisdictions saying that the assertion of innocence must be credible. And in terms of legal support, the closest thing I could find in Wisconsin was the Leitner case, where Leitner moved to withdraw his guilty plea based on the fact that now his girlfriend could come provide an alibi witness. So that wasn't his assertion of innocence. That was his reason for withdrawing his plea. But, of course, the alibi witness implicitly is there to support an assertion of innocence. And in Leitner, the court found that the alibi witness and his reason for not having her before were not credible. In terms of, I think, really the more important question is how important is the assertion of innocence, I think that the black letter answer to that question is that it's an important factor, but not dispositive, the absence of which militates against plea withdrawal. That's what this court said in Dewdrey. The statement has been repeated over the years, most importantly in the Court of Appeals' own decision in Shanks. So I think that the courts have said over and over again it is an important factor. I think there's another important question here. Is it a prerequisite to making a valid pleading? Is it sort of a pleading requirement? If you don't make an assertion of innocence, can the court then just per se say, okay, out the door, you can't withdraw your plea? I don't think that it's that kind of pleading requirement. But I think that the cases do warn defendants that if they don't assert their innocence, they do so at their peril.
Ms. Whalen, let me ask you about the standard of review. The interesting question has been raised regarding the standard. The state has argued that this is an erroneous exercise of discretion standard. but we're dealing with the concept of fair and just reason.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a legal standard? And if so, does that require de novo review?
Whether the reason itself is fair and just in terms of the sort of original Libke standard, that's a very basic question that I'm sort of blanking on now. I think the answer is probably yes, that would be subject to de novo review, whether the reason asserted by the defendant provides a fair and just standard. I think that's really a legal statement, and I can't think of a reason that the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court with the proper record wouldn't be able to review that issue de novo. But that, I don't think, is what happened here. I think what happened here has to do with the, as Shanks puts it, a misunderstanding of the plea or its consequences is a fair and just reason for plea withdrawal, but that misunderstanding must be genuine. The concern that the state has in this case is that the circuit court concluded that the defendant's claim of misunderstanding was not genuine, and the Court of Appeals said, well, no, it is genuine. And I think this flies in the face of cases such as Jeske, which say the job of the Court of Appeals is not to decide what's right or wrong, but to determine whether the circuit court reached a decision that is not supported by the facts of record. And the facts of record the Court of Appeals looked at were the letter from defense counsel to Jenkins and defense counsel's narrative explanation to the circuit court about what was going on in terms of trying to get together with the police, and his ultimate conclusion that, yeah, I really think that Jenkins thought he had a promise, a sort of a quid pro quo thing here. Getting back to an earlier question, by focusing on those two points, the Court of Appeals was in fact focusing on what the defense counsel thought, not what Mr. Jenkins thought. The letter to Jenkins, of course, is written to Jenkins, not by him, and how he interpreted it is open to question. The letter set out a four-step process, basically. Plead guilty, you can meet police from Vice and Narco. If there are productive arrests, maybe you'll get some sentencing benefits. I think...
Ms. Whalen.
Yes.
It's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Mr. Jenkins actually met with the Milwaukee police. Isn't that right?
Indeed, he did. So
isn't that significant for the court in weighing the situation?
Well, yes, I think it's very significant because in that letter, there's argument over whether it should be subject to a subjective or objective interpretation under reasonableness. Objectively, it certainly seems that what is said in that letter and what you would expect Mr. Jenkins to infer is, if I plead guilty, I'm going to meet with the police. That was something he could very reasonably understand, and that, in fact, did happen. The next part of the letter, the next step, if you will, is if there are productive arrests. Mr. Jenkins is not a first-time offender. He's been around the block. He knows that a lot more goes in, that there's a lot that has to go into a productive arrest. And it is the circuit court concluded, held, that it was unreasonable for him to infer from this that he had some kind of guarantee of further cooperation and sentencing benefits. Now, I think that the unreasonableness of objective unreasonableness of his inferring from this particular letter that he had some kind of guarantee is underlined by those two pieces of evidence that the state relies on, one, the plea colloquy, and two, his answer to Judge Lamelis when she asked him, what was your understanding of what was going to happen? He was there. He had the opportunity to answer that question, and he didn't answer the question.
One of my concerns is, although we talk about objectively reasonable, it seems to me that there's a real subjective component to what is objectively reasonable. So we go through this legal gymnastics. I think of the students here, and I think of in those thrilling days of yesteryear when I had children their age. And if what's the question is, what's objectively reasonable for a 16-year-old who just got their driver's license to believe? Question. Mom, can I have the car Friday night? Written answer in concrete. If I'm not busy. Now, wouldn't it be objectively reasonable for those students to say, oh, better not make certain plans for Friday night because Mom said I can use it if she's not busy. Who knows? She's busy all the time, probably can't use it. No. It seems to me that the objectively reasonable 16-year-old would say, got a green light. Boy, can I use that car on Friday night, because unless it's a no, it's a yes, you know. So that's the subjective component here. And here you got a defendant who's, you know, who knows, but from one perspective is chomping at the bit to try to get a deal. You know?
And I agree with you. And that is why the state did not really focus on that objective-subjective analysis and really emphasize the reasonableness of Mr. Jenkins' on appeal stated interpretation of that's what I thought the letter meant. I think that if we had that letter plus Mr. Jenkins saying to Judge Lamelis when asked directly minutes or maybe 10 pages after his defense counsel said, I think he thought he had that guarantee. With that wonderful setup, if Mr. Jenkins had said, yes, defense counsel is right, that's what I thought, that's what I meant. But he didn't say that. And therefore, this how should this letter be interpreted, I think it doesn't make sense to interpret it as supporting what he says on appeal when, coupled with his failure to back that up with a statement in court in front of the judge in response to a question when she could see him and look at him and determine whether he was telling the truth.
Were there two letters written here, one that the that was received from the department, I'm talking about the Milwaukee Police Department, and then wasn't there a letter that Jenkins wrote to the circuit court talking about his appeal? So there really were two.
Well, the letter I think we're talking about now is the letter, maybe we should be very, I should be specific.
Well, is it the letter that he wrote explaining why he made his plea and why he thought he had to admit his guilt?
First, the letter I've been talking about is the December 19th, 2002 letter from Paul Barrett to Mr. Jenkins.
Yeah, well,
the other letter is a letter Mr. Jenkins wrote to Judge Lamelis.
That was a seven-page letter.
Right.
Which he said he claimed that he pled guilty because he thought he had to admit his guilt in order to receive a benefit from the assistance that he thought he might provide to law enforcement. Mm-hmm. But his reply, if there was a reply, and then there were some adjournments. But what I'm saying, there was a letter, and mm-hmm. then he wrote a letter what he mm-hmm. thought about it.
And I think that the statement in the letter that I believed I had to plead guilty to open the door or as an entree into this process, I don't think that there is any question about that. And that's not really what the problem has been. The problem is, what did that process give me? Did it give me some guarantee down the road that I was going to get the sentencing benefit in my wildest hopes, dismissal, or am I hoping that I might be able to get some benefit? I think that we can look at Mr. Jenkins as someone who arguably he did have the misidentification motion on one hand, but on the other hand, the record shows him identified by three police officers. He's also someone that we find in the sentencing hearing has a very serious record.
Counselor, could I just interrupt
yes.
a minute? Before your time is up, I have a question I've been wanting to ask. Justice Butler asked you whether a fair and just reason was a legal conclusion based on fact found. And as I understand you, you said yes. And I can understand that. So it's kind of like probable cause. We have these facts, and do they fulfill that standard? My concern is this. Many of the cases I read say that the trial court did or didn't erroneously exercise his or her discretion in denying plea withdrawal. So if you have a legal conclusion that there is a fair and just reason, where's the discretion in ever not just permitting withdrawal, or is the discretion someplace before you get to concluding there's a fair and just reason? I have trouble fitting all that together.
Yeah, now that you put it that way, it seems confusing, and
it is,
I think,
confusing
that the stay here has emphasized that the circuit court's discretion is really playing out in the factual analysis and balancing determining credibility, balancing where you come out on whether the facts support the fair and just reason.
But you know, if you think about discretion, it's when there isn't an absolute answer. So the trial court has some latitude to say yes or say no. When you find facts, you either find someone's credible or you find they're not
right.
credible. So
yeah.
it's in my mind a very different process than what I usually think of as discretionary. So I'm having difficulties lining up what the cases say with kind of how some of the parts of it feel.
Well, maybe the way it fits together is the Libke standard is something that goes back a ways. And in recent years, the court has refined its statement of what exercise of discretion is. And the statement is a court exercises its discretion properly when it follows the law and applies it reasonably and logically to correctly found facts. So maybe that statement of the discretion standard says, yes, the circuit court does have discretion, but it's modulated by having to make a correct legal determination, which is one subject to de novo review. So maybe what's happened here is we've got a bit of de novo review sitting in a little puddle, a larger lake of a discretionary analysis.
You know, if that's correct, then what's wrong with what the Court of Appeals did?
Well, the Court of Appeals didn't defer to the factual findings at all, reweighed the facts. And what's particularly troubling is, with the way the Court of Appeals did it, is that the Court of Appeals did not simply say, here on this side of the balance is the letter from defense counsel and defense counsel's statement, at the sentencing hearing. And here on this side is the plea colloquy, which Judge Lamalis explicitly relied on, and the it's not too much about the time statement that the state also brought to our attention. No, all the Court of Appeals did was look at the evidence on this side of the scale, so that it didn't even make a clearly erroneous analysis. It didn't explain to us why Judge Lamalis's reliance on the plea colloquy was erroneous. So,
in along these lines, Kennedy, which is a 91 case, mm-hmm. goes through the history of this, goes through the ABA standards from which we took this concept,
mm-hmm.
goes through the federal rules, which also adopted the concept, and says we look to federal cases because they're all based on the same grounds. It then says on page 584 of the second, or 171 of Northwest, the burden is on the defendant to offer a fair and just reason for withdrawal of the plea, and that the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks as if fair and just reason might, in this, be a factual determination. Then goes on to say that whether these reasons presented an adequate reason for defendant's change of heart was up to the discretion of the circuit court, saying that the circuit court determines, as I see Kennedy, determines what's a fair and just reason. And then it goes on to say that at the its last sentence, a reasonable judge, considering the law, and the law here is fair and just reason, and the state's not prejudiced, the facts, and using a logical reasoning process, could have denied Kennedy's motion to withdraw his plea, as did the circuit court in this case. So it seems to say but that's all part of the discretion. And then in the prior sentence, it says, while we recognize that another judge or another court may not have reached the same conclusion in this case, it's not our function to take on the role of the trier of fact. Is that good law?
Yeah, I think so. I quote that in my brief. I'm sorry. I even go as far as to say that this case is controlled by these paragraphs in Kennedy.
Well, and in 99, the court had a Kivioja case, mm-hmm. and it says, as for the practical application of the test, this court has held that a fair and just reason contemplates the mere showing of some adequate reason for defendant's change of heart, citing Kennedy. Whether a defendant's reason adequately explains his or her change of heart is for the discretion of the court. That's at paragraph 27. So I'm still a little confused, but it would appear that at least those two cases just look at it as totally discretionary, but put in a very liberal interpretation.
Exactly. Another thing that's, when you bring up the liberal interpretation, that's confusing in this area is that Libke says very liberal interpretation, and then all these later cases say, but it's not automatic.
Absolutely.
And so there's that, well, where is that path? It's really hard to even see it.
It's right next to liberal. Thank you, counsel. Okay. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. We have counsel now, Melinda Swartz, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Barry M. Jenkins.
Good May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Melinda Swartz, and I represent the respondent, Barry Jenkins, in this case. I'm here today to ask this Court to uphold the Court of Appeals decision, which reversed the trial court's denial of Mr. Jenkins' plea withdrawal motion. The circuit court here erroneously exercised its discretion because it kept asking the wrong question. Here, the circuit court looked at this case through the lens of asking the question of whether the opportunity to cooperate with law enforcement was part of the attorney's understanding of what the plea agreement was, instead of focusing on the question of what Mr. Jenkins' understanding of that plea agreement was. If the court, the circuit court, had focused on the question of what Mr. Jenkins' understanding was, given the evidence in this record, it would have concluded that Mr. Jenkins had met his burden of proof of a preponderance of the evidence that he had a fair and just reason to withdraw his plea. Given the evidence in this record, that Mr. Jenkins believed that as a consequence of his plea, he would have the opportunity to cooperate with law enforcement, he has met that burden of proof. Now, the circuit court was asking the wrong question, the circuit court missed key pieces of evidence in the record at the motion to withdraw its plea. Looking at the, and I'm pointing to counsel's, what counsel, defense counsel advised the court that it had informed Mr. Jenkins. And I'm looking at page 136 of the appendix. This is defense counsel. He says, I was suggesting that I told him, referring to Mr. Jenkins, that he would have to accept responsibility as the entry card to doing this work. The assistant district attorney insisted on that. He said, referring to Mr. Jenkins, that's okay if I get to talk to these people. I have a lot to tell them, and then I proceeded to do the debriefing. Therefore, counsel told the court that the entry card to getting to do the work, in exchange for that, was Mr. Jenkins' guilty plea. He would have to plead guilty, and then he would get the opportunity. Later on, and I'm looking at page 155 of the petitioner's appendix, he again explains what the guilty plea and opportunity to cooperate was. And I'm looking at page 155 of the appendix, and he's talking about the letter that Mr. Jenkins had said to the court. I would try to put some of his context in comments and context for both him and the court in that the assistant district attorney is a very skilled assistant district attorney. And his quid pro quo for getting merit for cooperation was first the acceptance of responsibility. And that was a difficult concept for me to get across. You accept responsibility and take the plea deal with kind of an open-ended kind of thing. And I had frustration, but I was trying to get across to Mr. Jenkins. It is a difficult concept. And it continues. So therefore, counsel also told the court that he advised Mr. Jenkins that if he pled guilty, the quid pro quo for that was he would get the opportunity to cooperate with law enforcement. And that's also reinforced by the letter that he sent. The letter says, you plead guilty, you get the opportunity to cooperate.
And the now, counsel, this is basically there was a heroin deal that went down, as they say, but the plea deal didn't. So in other words, this is just a apparent plea negotiation that was not really, let's say it was not completed. It didn't come to pass. There wasn't any. So do we really look, how important is it when we look at this, whether we look, do we look at whether or not Mr. Jenkins has asserted his innocence? He hasn't done that, has he?
Your Honor, I don't.
Isn't that an important factor here?
I don't think it's an important
factor. Really? Why not? Isn't that what this is
Your
all
Honor,
about?
This court has never required that a person prove their innocence in order to be able to withdraw their plea under the fair and just standard. It's if it's relevant to the reason that he gave. Because the court has never required someone prove their innocence in a manifest injustice case, for example, in a Banger case.
But that's not the standard here. Manifest injustice is not the standard here, is it?
It's not the standard, but why, if we don't require it in a manifest injustice case, why is it required in a fair and just standard? The fair and just standard just looks at, does the person have the reason? The assertion of innocence might be relevant to the person's, for example, Shimmick talks about, in a footnote, about how the relevance of the assertion of innocence might be to whether someone was confused, or it might be relevant to coercion. But it's not a required element. There's all sorts of fair and just reasons that don't have to do with someone's innocence.
All right. I'll accept that. But the Chief Justice talked about the Kennedy case, and that case seems to say that, look, this is a discretionary call by the circuit judge. Judge Lemayus looked at this. She was in on the beginning. She knew about the letter that was sent. She had read the letter, and she felt that based on her assessment that there wasn't a fair and just reason. And she didn't even mention, as I did, that the assertion of legal innocence is an important factor. I don't even think either court went into that. So this is a discretionary call, and what you're saying is that this was an erroneous exercise of discretion.
Right. And that's because the court, it's not just making a decision. It's how the court comes to that decision. It's the whole process by which a court looks at it. The circuit court needs to look at the correct law and the correct facts as it's applied to that law.
And where did she go wrong?
Because what she did, and I disagree with the state here, she did not decide that his reason was not credible. She decided that it wasn't part of the plea agreement. That is how she exercised her discretion. Both orally, at the time that she denied the plea agreement on the record, she stated, Mr. Jenkins, and I'm looking at page 142, no one has a right to any kind of special treatment. Sometimes a plea agreement is reached that has certain specific parts to it that require one party to do something or the other party to do something else. And from what your attorney has told me and the state's attorney has told me, that was not part of the agreement here. So you had a hope that did not come to fruition. No, nothing happened. No one came to see you. But I don't see that was a violation of the plea agreement, and therefore I will not allow you to vacate your plea. All right? So the court accepts what he says about what he believed, but denies it because it wasn't part of the plea agreement. Therefore, the court's not looking at the right, it's not really evaluating this in the right law, which is looking at what his understanding is. Then post-conviction, where the court again looks at the plea agreement, the court says, and I'm looking, when the court is looking at the fair and just reason in its decision, and I'm looking at appendix page 124, where he's talking about, it says, the defendant submits that his misunderstanding about the plea agreement constitute a fair and just reason. And I'm next paragraph. Here there was not a genuine misunderstanding of the plea's consequences. The consequences of the plea were that the state would make a recommendation of 24 months and 24 months extended supervision, and the court would fashion a sentence based on the seriousness of the offense, the defendant's character, and the need for protection, community protection. The defendant may have thought that a more favorable sentence would have been imposed had he been able to connect with law enforcement authorities who would have appeared or spoken on his behalf, but this was not part of the plea agreement. Consequently, there was no misunderstanding about the consequences of the plea. For these reasons, there was not a fair and just reason to withdraw his plea. So, and that's how the court exercised discretion post-conviction. And it's not, again, not looking at the controlling legal question here, which is, what was the defendant's understanding? And that's to be viewed liberally. It's a liberal standard. And in order for what this...
What does that mean? It's a liberal... You mean you accept what the defendant, Chief Justice, said, that should be right next to the discretion, and it should be construed liberally. But I'm just saying that this was a judge that looked at all of these factors and then made a decision.
But I'm saying that I don't believe that she did look at the factors. And really, based on the record, based on what counsel said to her orally and counsel's letter, it doesn't really matter whether the two attorneys thought it was part of the plea agreement. It's what he did.
Ms. Schwartz, I want to focus on the letter because I have some concerns about what the letter means. When I look at the letter, it kind of begins, I was informed by Assistant District Attorney Stephen Glam, that you wrote to him concerning the possibility of getting some benefit for some information you know. It is often possible to work out some arrangement where a defendant gets credit for what he gives, for what aid he gives to the police. He might even get enough credit that the police would testify. It goes on. Mr. Glam is willing to work out some arrangement, but he insists that you take responsibility first. This discusses the acknowledgement of the hand-to-hand buy from the police officers. If you work with the officers, if you then wish to work with the officers, that can be arranged. You would be debriefed and given use immunity for anything you told them. If there were productive arrests for your information, you would be given credit. You might be given a lot of credit if you further testified against the perpetrators. Bear in mind that all of this is predicated on acceptance of responsibility for the crime for which you were charged. There's a lot of conditions in what the defense counsel advised, at least in writing his client, that if, then, maybe, possibly. And so when we focus on what the defendant understood in terms of the plea agreement, and following up on Justice Crook's question, that there was at least some debriefing that took place. He did meet with Milwaukee police officers. Do we have enough here to say there was an expectation that there was going to be some ongoing purchase or some buy or something beyond what he actually got?
Your Honor, our position is he didn't get the opportunity to complete that cooperation. Our position is that the letter clearly states if he pled guilty, and if you then were to work with officers, that can be arranged. The problem here is he didn't get that complete opportunity because the court would not adjourn the sentencing for him to connect with federal law enforcement officials.
Well, the reason I asked the question is, at least in this letter, it doesn't say federal. It says if you then wish to work with officers, and he did meet with officers. I'm not sure that there's anything more here, at least in face of the letter, that was expected. And I'd like you to clarify that for me.
I think that his expectation, let's remember why he couldn't work with the state officers. The reason why he couldn't work with this, why the state, who had made this offer to him, didn't allow him to work with their own officers was because he was incarcerated, which is what they knew at the time that they sent the officers up there. So it's also kind of inequitable for them to say, well, he had his opportunity because they knew he was incarcerated, and they're saying in order for him to get credit, he's going to have to make a transaction. And so then what they do is they allow him, because his attorney asked for permission, to go to the federal authorities to say, and they agree to that. So he meets with a liaison prosecutor, someone who's from...
He was incarcerated at all times. He didn't get out to meet with him. I mean, they came to see him.
They came to see him, and they told they had very good information. In fact, they even met with defense counsel afterwards in person. And then the state, gave him permission to go to meet with the federal government, but there was a delay. And at the time that the court would not agree to adjourn the case or allow him to withdraw his plea, at least there was some information in the record that the IRS, that the assistant district attorney, who was a special liaison to the federal government, had said that the IRS, that he was going to contact the IRS or people from tax to see whether they would be willing to work with Mr. Jenkins, given his offer of proof. So I think that that's... And one point I do want to make about what the state has said. The state said during their argument that Mr. Jenkins should have popped up and said, yes, what my attorney said was right about what his understanding was of the plea agreement. But that's holding a layman to invoking some legal concept, to invoking a legal concept in front of the court. And in fact, Mr. Jenkins himself did say words to the effect that he was expecting, that he had agreements from the state. And I'm looking at page 141 of the appendix. The defendant says, stipulations that I'm not able to fulfill, what I had my projections on. I'm sure the federal agents are willing to speak with me. Defense counsel has done a lot, you know, in regards to this, and it's on this basis, the sole basis is it was initially my part, my purpose of entering the plea that I entered, which was a guilty plea, and I would just like to withdraw my plea. Remember, this is a client at this, or a defendant, who at the most, according to the record, guilty plea questionnaire, has a ninth grade education, and who's pro se at this point. He is having to explain to the court why he wants to withdraw his plea because his attorney, it wasn't part of the plea agreement, so the attorney didn't make that motion for him. And I think looking at the words that he said in his explanation, and I think this is also shows how the court didn't exercise its discretion because the court didn't ask him, follow up on that. The court never asked him directly at the plea withdrawal motion, what was your understanding of the plea agreement? Did you believe that the opportunity to work with law enforcement was part of your plea agreement with the state? The court didn't ask that question because the court wasn't focused on the controlling legal question here.
Well, when they testified, the prosecutor testified as to the plea agreement, didn't say a word about opportunity to work with the police, right?
Right.
Okay. The defendant said he agreed with that, right?
Are you talking about at the plea hearing?
The original plea hearing, yeah.
What Mr. Jenkins actually said at the original plea hearing was the court asked him, is that what the state is required to recommend? And he said yes. And that was true at that time, because he was still waiting for the opportunity to cooperate.
Okay. And then we get into sentencing, and the defense counsel asks for a delay in the sentencing so that they can work out some things. Right?
That's right.
Okay. And the things that they were going to work out relate to cooperation with either the Milwaukee County.
Right.
With the Milwaukee police or with the feds, as it turned out.
That's correct.
And during that interval, they don't seem to be able to work out with anybody. And he asked for a further delay, and it's not given. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So then you get to sentencing, right? Then what does the defendant actually say at sentencing? Does he ask to withdraw the plea before sentencing?
Yes, he does.
Yes, he does.
Yes,
okay.
He does.
And what's his explanation at that time?
That was the stipulations.
Okay.
That's his pro se.
All right. And so it's your position, if I'm hearing you correctly, that although the terms of the plea agreement with the state may have been as stated, at least the defense counsel led the defendant to believe an opportunity for a deal with law enforcement was possible.
Right, but I also think it was the state, too. And
okay.
I want to explain why. The state does not technically want the opportunity to cooperate. It's not, they don't want that technically to be part of the plea agreement, even or part of the plea bargain, because otherwise, if Mr. Jenkins is able to provide information and have to testify, obviously his testimony could be impeached if it is really part of the plea agreement, or the stated terms of the plea agreement, but really, this was part of the plea agreement. What they wanted, there's two terms of this plea agreement. They wanted not to have to prove their case. They did not want to have to meet their burden of proof, so they gave him a sentencing recommendation. He wanted the opportunity to cooperate, and they said, if you want the opportunity to cooperate, we'll give it to you. But it had, both of those terms had the same operating, triggering factor, which was his guilty plea. Now, they don't want to say on the record that's part of the plea agreement, but in fact it was.
Because it damages his credibility in further cases.
That's right. So
because the last, right. Were you promised anything, did you get leniency, et cetera.
That's right. And that's why it seems kind of inequitable for them to be sitting here and saying, you know what, he really didn't have a true understanding.
You're surmising all of that on the basis of your experience and on the basis of our understanding of how the criminal justice system really works, which was Judge Fine's basic problem with this whole case.
Right.
As to the plea agreement. But at least at a minimum, it would appear on the face of the record that defense counsel told the defendant that there'd be an opportunity maybe to work with the law enforcement, which would be a credit to him in the ultimate sentence. I don't mean credit time, but that the circuit court judge would consider that, et cetera. So if that's true, at least as to the defense side, your position is that that's what the circuit court should have concentrated on because that was his understanding, if not from the state, at least from his own lawyer.
That's correct.
Therefore, he had a misunderstanding maybe caused by his own counsel, but caused anyway.
That's right. And it's a liberal standard. I mean, it's a very liberal standard. He just has to show a mere adequate showing of a reason to withdraw his plea.
You think that's just cause? You think it is just and fair, whatever the language is?
It's a fair and just reason. He has to show an adequate reason for his change of heart.
Right.
Okay? That's all he has to show. He just has to show it by a preponderance of evidence. It's a very liberal standard because it's pre-sentencing.
Okay. Now, suppose I agree with you, suppose, and then I think it, if I was sitting as the circuit court judge, I would have said, listen, withdraw your plea. We'll take it to trial. It's going to be faster and easier than your appealing a post-conviction motion. That's another hearing, although she didn't get it, but he got a decision. Now we go to the Court of Appeals. Then we go to the Supreme Court. Try the darn thing. You got cops who are going to identify him and agree to the charge, and it'll be over. But I would have done that, maybe. But this judge didn't. So what's the standard of review? I mean, two reasonable judges can come to two different explanations and
decisions. But it's about, excuse me, it's about the process. I mean, the court here, because as the court quoted from Kennedy, it's a logical reasoning process. And here, because the court didn't look at it through the lens of what the defendant's understanding was, that's why it's an erroneous.
It was a mistake of law here.
It was a mistake of law, and that's why, because the facts are, the court accepted the fact that he had this belief in making its decision under fair and just, this court has the legal question, is his misunderstanding a fair and just reason to withdraw his plea? It's a legal standard because the court accepted his misunderstanding but applied the wrong law to that misunderstanding. And that's our position. Because otherwise, it's just making a decision.
What about the innocence bit?
I do not believe this court has never said that someone needs to prove that they're innocent in order to withdraw their plea.
It may not be determinative, but it's certainly mentioned in the cases. I mean, I can go back and look at those cases.
It is mentioned in the cases, and you know, I know it's mentioned in Dudry, but the court has never completely explained why that a person must assert their innocence. However, he did that, okay? And if it's that somehow going to militate against his withdrawal, it doesn't here, because not only did he assert his innocence, he asserted his innocence way back in a letter, I believe sometime in early December, where he raised the issue of misidentification. He reiterated his innocence prior to the plea withdrawal motion in the letter that was mentioned by Justice Crooks to the court. And he, again, post-conviction reiterated his assertion of innocence. So in that way, he's asserted his innocence, so it militates in favor of his withdrawal.
Ms. Schwartz, doesn't that have to be a credible assertion, though?
The court has never said that. And here's the thing. People have all sorts of reasons for why they might plead guilty. And one more thing I want to say about assertion of innocence. Let's not forget that the letter also required him, in his mind, to that he had to admit that it was he who delivered the drugs to the officers. That's what the letter from counsel said. So in that regard, anything that he said, if he thought that he had to do that as part of his plea negotiation to get the opportunity to cooperate, that should be taken into consideration. And no, I don't think that there's anything that says it has to be a credible assertion, that is required as part of the fair and just standard.
Why would you want to require it at all if it weren't credible? I mean, what's the sense of saying, well, hey, I'm just, you know, there are three people saw me standing there. I said, yeah, I was the guy that was standing on the corner. And then he comes in and says, oh, no, you know, it wasn't me. I wasn't standing on the corner. I don't see why have it as a requirement or even a helpful part of the examination if it doesn't have to be credible.
I think that this court should clarify that, because I think that Dudry says, without really any explanation, that you have to assert that you're innocent, okay? However, either Shanks or Shimmick, the Court of Appeals says, well, listen, it's relevant to whether – it's not itself a factor. It's not itself a fair and just reason. But it goes to whether – if it's relevant to the asserted reason, it might be it might be a factor for the court to consider. For example, coercion by counsel. Let's say that a person kept saying that they were innocent and their attorney didn't go and they didn't do any, all these things, but they explained their innocence, they explained the process by which they entered a guilty plea. That assertion of innocence, if it's credible, might also bolster their coercion by counsel.
I agree with that. I just want to be clear. My question was not directed at whether you were required to withdraw a plea, required to allege innocence in order to be able to withdraw a plea pre-sentence. It was just whether, if that statement was made, it had to be a credible statement.
I don't believe this Court has ever required that. And
well, my concern was, if in fact we're going to consider it at all as part of the mix, why would we consider something that's not credible?
I think that what the reasoning from the cases say is that the reason why a person has to assert their innocence is because, therefore, if they don't assert their innocence, anything that they said during the plea colloquy could militate, could affect their, that could be used against them if they were, in fact, going to trial. So that's how I see this assertion of innocence. And I want to go back to the fact that we don't require people to prove that they're innocent in order to withdraw their plea, either under the fair and just standard or under a manifest injustice standard.
Counsel.
Is an assertion of innocence in and of itself a fair and just reason?
This Court has said no. Or I shouldn't say this Court has said no. I don't know that this Court has directly addressed that issue, but at least the Court of Appeals in, it's either Schimmick or Shank, says that an assertion of innocence and a prompt motion to withdraw are not themselves a fair and just reason to withdraw the plea.
Well, as I understand it, an assertion of innocence is not a fair and just reason by itself, or I think I'd like a trial. That's not a fair and just reason. What are some sort of other arguments that would not constitute fair and just reasons if it's a mere adequate, some adequate reason? What isn't an adequate reason?
Well, I think this Court has said it's not a mere desire to go to trial. Like, I've changed my mind. I want a trial. That's not, I believe that this Court has said it can't be. It has to be something other than a desire to go to trial. And I think that's why perhaps an assertion of innocence is not, this Court is not a fair and just reason.
Now I've forgotten whether you put it in the affirmative or negative. What are fair and just reasons? Like?
Coercion by counsel, case confusion in entering the plea, misunderstanding of the consequences of the plea. Which is what we have here in this case. And really, I think that what this case is all about is really about the fair and just standard. And really, in order for the fair and just standard to work right, it has to be applied liberally. And what does that mean? That means if you have a reason, if the defendant has a real reason, he must be able to withdraw his plea. And we have to look at what the defendant's reason is. But it also means if you don't have a reason, if it's just a reason to go to trial, then it's not a fair and just reason. And that's really what the case law is.
New evidence might be a fair and just reason. There was a case we had that dealt with recantation.
That's correct.
And the Court went through whether you need corroboration, et cetera. I think they finally decided that it wasn't a good enough reason in that case, if I remember the case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so but this Court has never defined what fair and just reasons are, because it's not something that this Court has said is subject to scientific exactness. I mean, there's all sorts of things that could come up in the future that may be a fair and just reason. And that's why the Court's never really clearly defined what a fair and just reason is, because it just has to be some adequate reason for the defendant's change of heart.
You know, when I read these cases, I started out with, the ABA said where you had a fair and just reason, the trial court may allow a withdrawal, right? Our case then said, not may, but should. We took it a step up, seeming to favor allowing withdrawal. This is all pre-sentence. Then the ABA standard was modified to be more like Wisconsin.
And the federal cases cited in our cases ranged all the way, you want to withdraw, go ahead, we'll try you, to asking for more. But as I read the Wisconsin cases, there's an increasing view that it's not so liberal. You may have said it's liberal, but it isn't so liberal. And that unless the circuit court says we're going to let you do it, this court, and I'm not so sure about the Court of Appeals, has just not been favoring withdrawal. Am I reading these cases wrong?
Can I answer the question? My red light's on.
I suggest you do.
I would say that I see what the court is saying, but that is why I think this court needs to reiterate that it is a liberal standard and that it should be, it has to go back to what it said in Lipke and Dudry, that in fact, if the defendant presents an adequate reason for his change of heart, the circuit court should allow him to withdraw his plea pre-sentencing. And I think that needs to be emphasized by this court.
So it ends up being up to the defendant rather than the court.
No, Your Honor.
No, you said that if they give a reason that the court should do that. I mean, here the court analyzed the reasons and came to a different conclusion.
But the court didn't look at his misunderstanding. The court said it was because it wasn't part of the plea agreement. And that's different
the court, than... It was his subjective misunderstanding. That's the point.
But that's the law.
Yeah.
It's his understanding.
Yeah.
So the court misapplied the law here.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
Seems to me the dilemma that we're facing in this case is this. You have an increasingly complex plea colloquy where the court is required to discern the defendant's understanding on multiple different questions. And what seems to be at stake here is that you can have a flawless plea colloquy and a plea agreement that is honored, at least in terms of the letter, by the state, and still go outside of those things and undo everything in the plea before sentence with just an adequate reason.
But all the part, I mean, if the court look, I mean, it's really what did the defendant understand as a consequence of his plea? And I think it's pretty clear that he thought that part of his agreement with the state in this case was he would get a complete opportunity to work with law enforcement. And they didn't honor their end of what he thought his bargain was. And that's different. If for some reason the attorneys did not put that on the record, it doesn't negate what his understanding was of that agreement. And there's objective facts in the record that support his understanding, what his attorney said and the letter said.
Well, is this a no? Are you arguing that his guilty plea was not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary?
Your Honor, I don't believe I need to meet that standard, but I would say that his misunderstanding of the plea would also meet the manifest injustice standard. But because
you don't have to do that.
But I don't have to do that because it also meets the fair and just standard.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Whalen, you have 5 minutes.
If I could, before you get started, I'd kind of like to follow up where Ms. Schwartz left off with the question that was just asked by Justice Prosser, because I also have some concerns about the record. And I recall days when, both as a practitioner and as a judge, these issues would come up. And there was the tricky issue of how you dealt with it in open court, because, of course, if you put on the record in open court that a person is about to become an informant for a police department as part of a plea negotiation, it destroys any viability of the person being able to go out there and work for the police because it's now out in public. So there was always that tiptoe, that dance that you couldn't put it on the record in open court, because if it got on the record, you couldn't use the individual. That seems to be a problem.
Well, that's very interesting that you say that, because you have finally offered a possible answer to the question that I've been repeatedly asking. Why did Jenkins never even suggest that he didn't give a different answer to that question? And not having ever been a circuit court judge or a criminal trial lawyer, this is not something I'm familiar with, but I would believe that just as other evidence or factual statements are made in camera, if that was the concern, then some kind of mechanism could have been set up so that he wouldn't be put in that position. So that's my answer to that. And also, following more directly to Justice Prosser's question, I think the fact that the Court of Appeals so blatantly ignored the plea colloquy argument is really troubling, because it seems whatever the basis of your plea withdrawal motion is, that the court's first step to analyzing that withdrawal motion should be the plea colloquy. And if the plea colloquy is going to be completely ignored, it implies that plea colloquy is meaningless, that it's just a ritualistic, formalistic march through meaningless phrases. And if that's the case, I think we've got problems that are much more serious than the ones relating to, well, how do we interpret Libke and Kennedy and the assertion of innocence? I think that just raises a really fundamental problem.
Counsel, with regard to the colloquy, that makes my mind turn to this assertion of innocence. When there is an arguably inadequate plea colloquy and a request for a hearing on a motion to withdraw a plea, our case law says you have to assert that you didn't know it. In other words, it wasn't. I wasn't told what the nature and extent of the sentence would be, and our case law says in order to get an evidentiary hearing, you have to assert that you didn't know it, and then the burden shifts to the state. Is there any case law that you're familiar with that indicates that the assertion that you didn't know it has to be put through a credibility test before you can get a Bangert hearing? Now, in other words, there's been some discussion earlier about the assertion of innocence. Mm-hmm. Isn't there an assessment of credibility with regard to that assertion? Now, the assertion that you didn't know it is a pleading requirement under Bangert. Mm-hmm. You had said that assertion of innocence is a factor, but not a pleading requirement in your prior comments. But what about credibility vis-a-vis the assertion that you didn't understand it? Is there any case law?
No, I don't know of anything directly on point. I think you're raising the more general question, which I think is an important one, about maybe he should have had a hearing. Is that part of what
you can take it where you are? I really.
Okay.
Can I start now?
I have a big note here to remind myself and everybody else that on the first, is it Wednesday of the month,
yes,
we test the alarms. And that,
I've been here on other Wednesdays.
That is the test.
Okay. Well, I'm going
they
to.
They work. Okay.
I feel that I can speak through this level. Is that okay? Or should I wait until
we
it's completely over?
Ahead.
Okay.
It will be over in a few moments.
Okay.
Counsel, my question was not regarding a hearing. It was more in the sense of if we have a requirement that you assert you did not know, and that's a pleading requirement that doesn't contain a credibility assessment, why would we have a credibility assessment with regard to a factor That's not even a pleading requirement, an assertion of innocence. So my thought was, boy, if there is a credibility component to the pleading requirement, then that bolsters maybe there should be a pleading a credibility requirement for an assertion of innocence. If there isn't, then I think it diminishes it. And so I'm just wondering the case law.
Okay, so what your question really is, I think, is that under Bangert and Nelson, you come in with a facially adequate motion that says whatever. You get a hearing. I don't know that if your facially adequate motion is clearly, if you make conclusory allegations that are clearly inconsistent with evidence in the record prior to filing your motion, that you should I don't know the answer, but it seems to me that you shouldn't be entitled to a hearing on the basis of those allegations either, because if they're facially plausible, but we've got really good stuff. I mean, for example, you could say in your motion, well, the court didn't ask me if I knew what the sentence was, and so therefore I can withdraw my plea. And you look at the plea colloquy transcript, and there's the court saying this is the sentence.
It has to be facially inadequate and an assertion that you didn't know. So
yeah, and it can be facially adequate, and that's fine. But if there is something in the record that shows your facial statements are false, then it's sort of like the shifting presumptions, I would think. But on the question, because I don't think it's before the court, but in Jenkins' brief, there were allusions to the fact that the court didn't give enough credence to statements made in his post-conviction motion, and that really these things, he should have gotten a hearing to test the credibility of his assertions. And my response to that is that if the circuit court's error was a failure to grant Jenkins a Bentley hearing, then the proper remedy for the Court of Appeals was to remand the case for a hearing, not to go behind the circuit court's fact-finding and make its own. We would have disagreed with that result, because we feel the record supports the circuit court's conclusion. But I think it would have been an appropriate use of the Court of Appeals review authority. I wanted to make just a couple of other things. First of all, the State has never suggested that the innocence needs to be proven, just that a credible assertion be made, and that's obviously, it just seems obvious to me that's a different standard. The other thing that I wanted to address is a kind of a framing issue.
You have to address it very rapidly.
Just to say that Judge Lamalis did not, where she addressed the credibility is at the end of her opinion, having gone through fair and just, weaving through ineffective assistance of counsel, and then saying at the end of that part of her opinion, and besides, his claim of confusion is incredible in view of his own previous statements.
Thank you, Ms. Whalen, and thank you, Ms. Swartz, for your excellent discussions about pre-withdrawal pre-sentence. That concludes our hearing in 2005, AP 302-CR, State of Wisconsin versus Jenkins. Students who wish to may leave. We'll take a short recess so other students can enter the chambers. We're in recess.